You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Gerislein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org.
Everybody, welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. I am Rob Gerislein. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be with you for the next hour. We are really in the heart of hunting seasons now, so there's a lot to talk about. We'll actually have our non-game gal with us this week, Sharon Steitler, this week and next. I haven't talked to her since April, so it's a transition time for those folks who care about non-game topics, too. The migration is on. Eric Morkin, we will spend a bunch of time with him. He's the web editor here at Outdoor News, but he's also a hardcore whitetail deer hunter, archery deer hunter. He hunts like three states every year for deer via bow. And we will preview next Saturday, the 19th, archery deer opener with Eric. So stick around for that. Going to kick it off with our buddy Tim Lesmeister. Tim, welcome. Good to see you. The big news this week is we got our state pheasant reports, and it's up from last year. It's looking pretty good out in western Minnesota. Bad conditions for growing ducks kind of equal pretty good conditions for growing pheasants.
Absolutely. And there's a map in this print edition. You should take a look at it. It's kind of showing where the areas are that have the highest concentration of birds. That's where you want to hunt. Trust me, those maps are pretty accurate, and I'm telling you right now, it's like fishing on a lake. If you want to catch walleyes, you go where there's on a lake where there's a lot of walleyes. You know, if you want to shoot a lot of ducks, you go out to North Dakota and or South Dakota if you want to get into the heavy pheasants. But for Minnesota pheasant hunters, find those areas that got the highest concentration of birds, because you'll be happy you did. There's plenty of spots out there now with all the walk-in that you can actually hunt some pretty prime property and get into some really good shooting.
So they call it the August Roadside Survey. The DNR goes out every year. I think they have volunteers that help with this. They drive the same routes every year, Tim, correct? And they count the number of crowing incidences that they hear from the rooster pheasants, right? They hear them out there crowing and they mark it down. And they've been doing it for years, so they've got, you know, good data to compare it to. And the overall pheasant index, they call it, was up 20% from last year, you know, based on this 2026 August roadside survey. You know, to your point, the good news is the birds were up most of the state, but the areas where they were really up are the parts of Minnesota that you want them to be up. The you know, the hardcore pheasant zone, the pheasant portion of the state, the west central, central, and south central regions were up 74%, 25%, and 17% respectively. You know, that's the heart of pheasant hunting in Minnesota. You know, the southeast Minnesota, east central, southeast Minnesota, east central part of the state, they decreased a bit, and it, you know, it's kind of like, well, who cares? There's not a lot of pheasant hunting in that portion of the state anyway.
That's true, and you know where I hunt pheasants out in West Central, that's been kind of tough here these last few years, and now I see it's up quite dramatically, and I'm really pleased with that. But I like to go to the more obscure areas. I actually hunt around Alexandria, and you know, most people say, why are you going that direction, you should be heading farther west. And I say, you know, it's actually up by Evansville and around Alex. There's a lot of public ground there that no one hunts. You get out there with a good dog, you might not see as many birds as you would if you went down into southeastern Minnesota, but you're going to get some good shooting anyway, just because those birds aren't, you know, they're not targeted that hard. You know, I just am pleased to look at this map and see that they're mainly up and quite a bit up in a lot of good areas that I like to hunt.
We mentioned last week that Iowa, about the same as last year, and Iowa had a pretty solid year in 2025. We don't get an official forecast from South Dakota anymore because they just want everybody to think it's always wonderful every year out in South Dakota. They stopped doing that during the Noem administration. Let's not share any data with the public. Go figure. But all that said, I mean, it's been warm and dry, and that means pulling off good pheasant broods. And I think that holds true for South Dakota also. So it's probably going to be a pretty darn good pheasant hunting season.
Casey Wisemantle out in Brown County, out there near in South Dakota there, says it's going to be a banner year for South Dakota pheasant hunters. So, you know, if you can get a chance to get out to, you know, that Aberdeen area where he's at in South Dakota, you're going to have some phenomenal pheasant hunting.
Back to Minnesota, observers counted more broods, which generally bodes well for pheasant hunters. There were 93 broods per 100 hens, an increase from 82 broods per 100 hens last year. So that means, you know, just as we suspected, we probably pulled off a lot of hatch this year. There'll be a lot of younger birds out there. That bodes well, especially as you get into late season pheasant hunting. So the season begins on Saturday, October 10th at 9 a.m. That's still, what, a little less than a month out, Tim? Less than 4 weeks, actually. It looks like a good year to get out and chase pheasants in Minnesota.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, Phil Bougelet did a column this last print edition about using heavier loads, 3.5-inch loads for ducks, geese, and turkey. And I'm telling you what, I've gone to heavier loads for pheasants now, too, because a lot of these birds are getting up and they're flushing out a ways, even with good dogs. So get a chance, read that article by Phil, because you might want to think about that for pheasant hunting as well.
Tim, the DNR press release, I've been monitoring this release every year. And of course, 20 years ago, it also included Hungarian partridge. It included jackrabbit data. It doesn't really go into that in the press release anymore, other than cottontail rabbits. It says cottontail rabbit numbers higher than in the past 60 years. So, you know, I think the reason they don't go into a lot of detail on some of these other species is there aren't very many of them, especially white-tailed jackrabbits. But if you want to chase cotton,
on jackrabbits, what's the matter with you guys? Come on, you should be figuring out a way to build that population. I used to love it when I was a kid, flushing jackrabbits. I wouldn't even shoot at them. I just loved watching them. They're fast.
Yeah, no, they're a really cool species, and it's borderline tragic how low their numbers are now, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Intensive agriculture, row cropping's not compatible with jackrabbits. That, and I, you know, we'll come around to the fact there's a lot more aerial predators now than there were probably during the heyday of jackrabbit hunting 50 years ago. We've done a good job protecting birds of prey, but they're gonna pick off some jackrabbits.
And ducks and loons.
Well, okay. We'll make our segue here after I remind everybody you're listening to Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Dreisline. He's Tim Lesmeister. Yeah, we had a letter to the editor. I was going to talk about this later, but I guess this is a good time now. A letter to the editor responding to a story. Justin Rundberg did a story on a gentleman who's doing some loon research in Minnesota and Wisconsin and reporting that there's very few young loons surviving. And his thesis was something about the water's not clear enough for them to catch food anymore, something like that, which I didn't necessarily buy, given that we've got more zebra mussels out there now. And then maybe not in pure lake country, but they're creeping north that, if anything, have cleared the water up. But we had a letter to the editor. I think we got another one this coming week, Tim, from a couple people saying, you want to know why you don't have as many young loons surviving? Blame the eagles out there that prey on loon chicks, as well as trumpeter swans that tolerate fewer loons and other birds, including Canada geese, on these wetlands. I think there's a little bit of truth to this letter. I've heard this from other people. People who live in lake country, they report this frequently.
I watch it. I get to actually see this in action. I've seen it in Alaska when I've been up there fishing on the rivers. One year I was on the Nooshigak River, and I watched a couple eagles pick off about 3 mergansers in about a half hour, and they do that out in front of my dock. I have 2 eagles, 2 adult eagles that are here all summer long. And since those eagles moved in a few years ago, I have not seen any loons at all. Now, maybe they just decide that they don't want to be around where the eagles are. I don't know. But the mergansers usually definitely stick around, but they start off pretty big population. She's usually carting around about 10 little chickies when she hatches, and then there's usually only about 2 or 3 left by the end of the summer. And I think a lot of the times as I watch these eagles double up on these mergansers, they're pretty efficient at popping those things. And I'd say there is some truth to it.
Well, what is a loon, but ultimately a big merganser, right?
Yeah.
And I have no data to support any of this. This is all anecdotal observations that I've heard from a lot of people. And, you know, when you hear enough of it, you know, even someone like me who really relies on data starts to think, you know, maybe there's something to it. There's no doubt about it. There's a lot more eagles out there than there was 50 years ago. And that's a good thing. Another incredible wildlife success story. They've been protected by, you know, multiple federal laws. We banned DDT. We traditionally have prevented development around their nests, although the Trump administration is doing what it can to repeal everything related to environmental regulation in this country. But I definitely think it's a factor with loons. And again, I also want to beat up on trumpeter swans. And, you know, we also have been reporting recently, I think we had a letter to the editor about this too, that Canada goose numbers are down. Now, a lot of people are out there saying, praise the Lord. We had too many Canada geese. Okay, fine. But you know, a lot of us enjoy hunting Canada geese too, and we are killing fewer geese because there's fewer of them out there. And part of that is we put a lot of pressure on geese, but part of it is these trumpeter swans out there, we've replaced Canada goose biomass with trumpeter swan biomass.
Yeah, that's very little doubt about that. You know, they might be killing some of these younger geese, but I think that if they are doing anything at all, they're driving a lot of these geese away from wherever it is that they used to sanctuary. And and I saw people are seeing a lot less in that regard, but there is probably some mortality due to the trumpeter swans as well. So yeah, it's just one species replacing another. It's not unusual.
It's a zero-sum game out there in the wetlands, Tim. Can you stick around? We'll grab a break and circle back with you at the end of the show, Tim.
Absolutely.
That's our buddy Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him. Let's grab a break. We'll chat with the bird chick, Sharon Staitler, when we return. This is Outdoor News Radio.
Do you want to reforest your land? The Minnesota DNR's Field to Forest Cost Share program covers up to 75% of tree planting or direct seedings cost, plus a $500 per acre incentive payment on open lands like pastures or crop fields. There is a 3-acre minimum and funds are limited, so don't wait. Contact the DNR Stewardship Forester to get started today. Visit mndnr.gov/woodland-cost-share.
There are lakes across Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and beyond that are loaded with fish. And nobody's talking about them. Onyx Fish helps you find them. Search by species, filter for big walleye, trophy panfish, or eater crappies. Check satellite imagery, depth maps, and public access points, all before you leave the house. And now, Onyx Fish is available on Android for the first time. iPhone, Android, doesn't matter. Just download it and start planning. 7-day free trial, then just $35 a year. Onyx Fish. Find new lakes, get there with confidence.
Attention hunters, the Outdoor News Best Buck Contest, sponsored by Federal, is now underway. Whether by bow, rifle, shotgun, or muzzleloader, all hunters are welcome for the contest that runs through January 4th. Visit OutdoorNews.com for bragging rights and a shot at great prizes from companies like CVA Muzzleloaders, Baronet Blinds, Onyx, Vortex, SpyPoint, Wildlife Research Center, America's Gunsmith Shop, and Pete Boot Dryers. Click the Best Buck Contest link at OutdoorNews.com to learn more.
Your land is your legacy, but keeping it healthy and thriving means caring for it now and in the future. The Family Forest Carbon Program can help you do right by your land with guaranteed income, help developing a forest management plan, and advice from experts. If you own 30 acres or more of forest land, you may be eligible to enroll in the Family Forest Carbon Program. Visit familyforestcarbon.org and enroll today.
Fall is coming, so waterfowlers, listen up. When birds are cupped over the spread, the last thing you need is a misfire. The Rite Aces patented Inertia Plus system guarantees full bolt closure every single time. It handles light loads through 3.5-inch magnums with oversized controls for cold weather gloves, and its airy recoil pad reduces felt recoil up to 30%. Get elite performance and a lifetime warranty without the $2,000 price tag. Visit your dealer or RiteUSA.com today.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the Atlantic Flyway, Ducks Unlimited has been protecting and restoring critical habitat for nearly 90 years. We're working toward our next million-acre milestone, and we need your help. Whether you're great at selling event tickets, securing donations, lining up sponsors, or pitching in wherever, there's a role for everyone. Join the team that's making a real difference. Head to ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited, conservation for a continent.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Outdoor News Radio. I am Rob Gerisline. Happy to be with you for another segment. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you like the chatter here, check us out online at outdoornews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. It's that time of autumn, early autumn, late summer, early autumn, when I check in with my friend Sharon Steitler, the bird chick. She hasn't been with us, I think, since April, so I'm really happy to have her with us now. She's coming off the state fair that kept her busy. She submitted her crop art to the fair. Sharon, how did that go? Did you win any ribbons?
No, but I did not enter to get a ribbon. There were almost 600 entries this year, so trying to get a ribbon is bananas. But it's really fun to have something on the wall and to be part of what makes people go to the state fair. Yeah. And yeah, my pieces look good. I did a portrait.
You look fabulous.
I did a portrait of a friend of mine, and it was a complete secret to him. And so the best thing was opening day of the fair in the afternoon, I got an all caps text message that said, "Sharon, you sneak." And so
well, I was reading that the lines to see the crop art were taking hours. People were standing in line for hours to see the crop art.
Yeah. And I mean, when I first moved to Minnesota and went to the state fair the first time, I fell in love with crop art. I thought, oh, I would love to do this. But I was like, I don't know if I have the patience or the time or the know-how. But I've lurked in the crop art groups for years where people have shared tips and tricks. And my friend Gail is a big crop art pusher. The first time she entered, she got a blue ribbon. And so, yeah, I invited her over in February to discuss an idea. And she bustles in with like three bags and a projector and seeds. And she said, "My husband is on standby. If we decide the size of your piece right now, he will cut it and bring you your board over and you can get started today." And yeah, 2 hours later, I was on my way to crop art.
So this will be something you do every year, you think, Sharon, or was this a one-off?
I definitely will do it again. I don't think I'm going to do two pieces again. And we can talk about this. I don't care about it. I went through cancer treatment this summer. And so I was not able to go birding or bike riding as much as I wanted, but I was totally able to glue seeds. And so it was also kind of a nice healing thing while I was going through that.
Well, I'm glad you had that. I'm glad you had Party, your dog, there. And I'm glad listeners can't see you. I can. You look great. And I'm glad to hear the treatment's going well for you, Sharon. Been a good friend for so many years on this program, and we're glad it's proceeding as well as possible.
I do have to share one more little anecdote. So one of my crop art pieces this year was painted, and it had some bright red stripes on it. And I was doing it out on my balcony one day, and my balcony is insane with hummingbird flowers. And this young hummingbird came in to test out the red seeds to sip it and left very disappointed.
So we're into mid-September already. Are the hummingbirds taking off here pretty soon?
They are, but this is the best time to attract hummingbirds if you still have a feeder out, because they're migrating. The adults head out first, and then the young of the year kind of linger. And so not only do we have more hummingbirds now than we do in the spring, they're moving, and they're moving slow. So I'm getting heavy hummingbird activity. I have this insane vine growing on my balcony called Cardinal Climber, which it's like a little red morning glory with these insane leaves, and the hummingbirds love it. And there's also this thing called bat face cupfia that you can find, and they're little red and purple flowers that look like little bat faces, and the hummingbirds love that. They'll go to those before they go to my nectar feeder.
And how soon will they be gone? Are they gone by the end of September, or will you still see? I mean, you know, September is summer now in this state, so.
Yeah. No, it's always been possible since I've lived in Minnesota in the 90s to have hummingbirds through early October. So I usually leave my feeder out either until October 15th or until it's been over a week since I've seen a hummingbird.
And these guys, they'll migrate all the way across the Gulf of Mexico into the Yucatan, into Mexico. Is that correct?
Yeah, they'll go over the Gulf of Mexico. Some will kind of curb around the side, but that's a much longer trip. But yeah, they can cross the Gulf of Mexico. And I just think that's insane. Like, oh, yeah. I have this young hummingbird that's very clearly recently fledged. And I'm like, man, in a month or two, you are going to be going over the Gulf of Mexico. That's just... And so then when you see hummingbirds come back in May... That bird has at least crossed the Gulf of Mexico twice, which right. is just crazy. And in many cases, more than that if they're older. But it's just in less than a year, they will cross the Gulf of Mexico twice. That's insane.
What should homeowners be planting? Obviously, they can't plant it now. But for next spring, if they want to attract hummingbirds with flowers or native plants, what should they be planting?
One of my absolute favorites, and especially if you have a yard that's a little more damp and shady, is cardinal flower. And you can get deals on what's called a basil rosette this time of year, because it takes 2 years for them to flower. Mm. And so if you plant the basil rosettes in the fall, you'll get these gorgeous red flowers, or almost crimson. And it's a late summer flower. So that's an amazing one. I think that's the one that I plant the most. That's my favorite native plants. And it's just, I already have my basil rosettes. You can even grow them in planters. You just got to stay on top of watering them.
You called it cardinal flower?
Yeah, cardinal flower.
This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisine. We're chatting with our friend Sharon Statler. She'll be with us here for this week and next week. She goes by the Bird Chick. That's the way to find her and see what she's up to on social media. Look for the Bird Chick and you'll see what she's got cooking. So since we last spoke, I went to Alaska, Sharon, and of course you spent, was it 3 years in Alaska?
Almost 3 years, yeah.
At Denali National Park. I was a little further north at Gates of the Arctic National Park. I had a couple interesting things happen. One, we were glassing one morning on the lake we were on, and someone said, there's a loon out there. And I got all excited. I grabbed my binoculars. I'm thinking, oh, Pacific loon or Arctic loon or red-throated loon. And it was a pair of common loons. all the way up there. So it was a bit of a buzzkill. I didn't see a lot of interest. I saw eagles that seemed a little spookier up there than the ones we have here. I saw an osprey, a whiskey jack. I'm sorry.
Gray jay,
right. Yeah. And then one morning we were sitting around our campfire and there were a bunch of birds up in a tree and Rob was the only guy who could ID them. They were crossbills and I got pretty excited about that. Something that I associate with winter in this part of the world. Then I'm talking to you off air and you're seeing crossbills in the summer here in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, crossbills are weird. They're very erratic. They're an eruptive species. Some years we get a ton and some years we don't get any. I remember my first winter back from Alaska. It was a warmish day and I had my window open and I heard a sound. I was like, oh, white-winged crossbills. I was like, wait a minute, that's an Alaska bird. But this year, the Midwest has experienced quite the eruption of red crossbills. And they've been popping up around Minnesota and in Wisconsin. And you usually find them in the tops of pine trees where there's a good crop of cones because that's what they're after. And I think it was a combination of some of the wildfire activity that we had that was pushing the birds out. Mm. But crossbills, they're kind of like an anytime, anywhere, I'm going to breed bird. I mean, they're documented nesting anytime. If there's enough pine crop and even if there's snow, they will nest. And so their migratory habits are a little all over the place too. So it can seem kind of weird to see what we associate as a winter species in July in Minnesota, but it's just one of those cool things to watch for.
And then you've got a unique bill, figure, given their name. It looks like their bill is kind of offset. It crosses over itself, and that's for breaking apart pine cones to get at the seeds?
Yeah. If you Google crossbill feeding, there are all kinds of videos that people have taken out there, especially in wildlife rehab centers where they'll set little pine cones down. And I think even Attenborough has this, but you can see them insert, because the beak is also kind of overgrown and that's what gives it cross. And so, yeah, they insert that and they open it and then their little tongue comes out and they get the little pine nut on the inside.
Very unique adaptation that looks pretty solid, right? As long as there's pine trees and spruce trees, that's going to work for them, I would think.
And sometimes in the wintertime, especially when we have snow, I have learned that I have crossbills just by looking down on the ground because they leave a very distinct mess underneath a tree where you find all little ripped up pieces of pine cone.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, I bet they're crossbills. And usually if I check that tree more than once within the week, I'll find the flock up there feeding on it.
Yeah, I think I've seen that many times in the Boundary Waters. You see these pine cones just all torn apart. It's like, what's going on there? Are there multiple species of crossbills?
There's two, like white-winged crossbills and red crossbills. And now ornithologists are separating out all the crossbills based on their chip note and on on the types of pine trees that they feed on. I am not this birder, but many of my friends are real gung-ho in trying to tell those chip notes apart. And as much as I am very good at birding by ear, in some cases, telling these chip notes apart involves recording it and then looking at the sonogram. And I'm just content to say, hey, that's a red crossbill.
We've talked about this. Yeah, these ornithologists, they've got time on their hands, don't they? They love subdividing everything. Crossbills, when you see them up close, they're a little bigger than you'd expect. They're not just some tiny little brown jabber. They're a healthy sized bird.
Yeah, they're considered a finch, but I feel like they're more closer in size to a cardinal than like a goldfinch or a purple finch.
Well, are cardinals technically finches?
Oh, cardinals are their own thing. I think cardinals actually got moved to tanagers a few years ago.
Did they really?
Cardinals are their own thing.
So for folks that are like, I want to see one of these crossbills, is the winter, I mean, like you say, they can pop up all the time, but is winter generally the best time to see them in Minnesota? And is that something to kind of watch for at feeders or to if you're going to go out birding up north to search for this winter?
Every now and then they show up at feeders, but really the best place to look for them is in the tops of pine trees.
Yeah.
You'll just notice a flock of birds moving along and they just all dart down into the top of a pine tree. Yeah, they're just after those pine cones and they usually try to stay as high as possible. But I've found too, like when I've watched a flock and I start going up and down the tree, they're just mixed in all over.
Yep.
But sometimes they do show up to feeders, and because of that weird beak, you know, someone who doesn't know birds very well will post the question, like, what's wrong with this bird's beak? And, you know, do I need to fit in? It's like, no, that's the way they roll.
Yeah. When we saw them in Alaska, they were behaving exactly as you just described. They were all the way up and down this pine tree, and you could see pieces of pine cone flying all over the place. So they were having a good time. Well, a fun segment with you as usual, Sharon. We'll get you back next week. There's lots of other topics. You'll join us again in 7 days.
Sure.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sharon. That was Sharon Stately, the bird chick. Just look for her on social media by searching bird chick and you'll see what she's got cooking. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
You're out here to catch fish, not chase eggs and milk around the woods. Chef Robert's Gourmet Breading Mix is built for the outdoors. One step, no mess, no fuss. Just wet it, bread it, fry it, and get ready for the crunch that legends are made of. Grab a 12-ounce resealable bag and feed the whole crew. Fish, chicken, turkey, duck, and more. Find Chef Roberts at chefroberts.com, that's chefroberts.com, and never miss a bite.
Do you want to reforest your land? The Minnesota DNR's Field to Forest Cost Share program covers up to 75% of tree planting or direct seedings cost, plus a $500 per acre incentive payment on open lands like pastures or crop fields. There is a 3-acre minimum and funds are limited, so don't wait. Contact the DNR Stewardship Forester to get started today. Visit mndnr.gov/woodland-cost-share.
Across America's Great Plains and down the Mississippi Delta, Ducks Unlimited has protected and restored habitat for nearly 90 years. We need your help to reach our next million-acre milestone and ensure waterfowl for generations to come. Whether you're selling tickets, securing donations, or finding that next sponsor, there's a role for everyone. Join today at ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited, conservation for a continent.
There are lakes across Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and beyond that are loaded with fish. And nobody's talking about them. Onyx Fish helps you find them. Search by species, filter for big walleye, trophy panfish, or eater crappies. Check satellite imagery, depth maps, and public access points, all before you leave the house. And now, Onyx Fish is available on Android for the first time. iPhone, Android, doesn't matter. Just download it and start planning. 7-day free trial, then just $35 a year. Onyx Fish. Find new lakes, get there with confidence.
From sunrise casts to sunset stories by the fire, Fireside Lodge is more than a fishing trip. It's an experience worth coming back to. Cast your line into pristine northwestern Ontario waters, reel in the catch of a lifetime, and unwind in comfort at the end of the day. Whether it's your first trip or an annual tradition, Fireside Lodge delivers the experience you've been waiting for. Book your 2026 adventure today at firesidelodge.com or call 1-800-545-0815.
Great hunting dogs deserve great nutrition. That's why Kinetic Performance Dog Food and Outdoor News have teamed up for the annual Huntin' Buddy Photo Contest. Developed for military and police canines, Kinetic helps fuel the energy, endurance, and recovery of hunting dogs and active companions. Now show us your best hunting buddy for a chance to win a year's supply of Kinetic Performance Dog Food. Enter by August 28th at OutdoorNews.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Gerisline. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Hope you like the content here. If so, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to our print or digital versions that way. We're past the state fair, so it's that time of year when I talk about Outdoor News making a great holiday gift. How's that? But hey, the holidays are still several months out. But what's not too far away is the Minnesota Archery Deer Hunting Opener. It's pretty late this year. It's next Saturday, September 19th. And a hardcore bow hunter who is here to give us some tips joins us now. His name is Eric Mork, and he's the web editor here at Outdoor News. He lives in western Minnesota, and he has already been out archery deer hunting because he lives close enough to another couple states that already have an opener cooking. Eric, thanks a lot for carving out some time to chat with me. How you doing? You've already been in North Dakota bow hunting, huh?
Yeah, thanks, Rob. I've been out in North Dakota for a few days of hunting out there and everything, and yeah, I always get out there for the opener and hunt the Dakotas a little bit, and in early September, it just gives me an opportunity to get out there before Minnesota's, which is always more in that mid to late September time period. So.
Yeah, it must be because of the way, you know, the first of the month or Labor Day fell or something, but this is about as late as an opener as I remember, Saturday the 19th. The Wisconsin opener is this weekend. It was on Saturday the 12th, so they're already bow hunting deer in Wisconsin. In some ways, though, we were talking a little bit off air, what North Dakota, their season opened on the 4th, South Dakota opened on the 1st. If you were out there hunting already in North or South Dakota, man, oh man, you were dealing with some heat.
Yeah, it was highs in the upper 80s this past weekend, and you can still get on deer at that time and everything, but you kind of got to think about the heat. And it's actually more, it's as much of a mental hurdle for hunters, I think, in terms of getting past that when you're out there. There's a lot that goes into that. You got to make sure that, I know for me personally, I'm really thinking about what shot opportunities I might get. I want a nice close shot, something like that. I always do, but you're really mindful of those things when you're hunting in that type of heat and everything, because obviously you got to think about meat spoilage and things like that. So there's a lot that goes into it.
There's a number of species that we hunt, you know, in August and September during heat. So this is not unprecedented, but it's a little different for white-tailed deer hunters who traditionally associate September with being, you know, cool. It's the start of fall. And it looks like we're talking about maybe some more seasonable temperatures next week. So that'll be good if that's what we get for that regular bow opener. Let's talk a little bit about food sources out there. That's always, you know, really important when we're thinking. We talk about a lot with bear hunting, but certainly with white-tailed deer too, and mast, right? That's the big word. I think we had two stories in Outdoor News this past week, one from Ryan Rothstein and one from our Outdoor News staff about the status of the oak mast out there, the crop of acorns. How's it looking in western Minnesota?
It's a pretty decent crop. I've seen, acorns are already starting to drop. I was out scouting even a week ago, and there were some red oak acorns that were dropping pretty well and everything. And I actually, on that property, I was seeing more scrape activity than I have seen at that time of year than almost any other time that I've been out scouting and stuff. So yeah, acorns are, you know, I'm writing a piece for us at Outdoor News on kind of what food sources look like across the state, depending on where you hunt and stuff. And that's a lot of the talk, obviously, when you're looking at early season, is the pulling power of acorns, white oak acorns especially. But, you know, even red oak acorns, they have more tannins, they're more bitter, and they might not be as palatable until later into the fall a lot of times. But if that red oak acorn is the number one food source that's going to get that deer ready for the winter that's coming up in your area, they can be big draws early in the season too and everything. So
you're going to be thinking a lot about water sources. Is that something that is kind of played into your strategy out in the Dakotas here in early September?
It definitely is. This year, especially, like I just looked at our drought map in Minnesota, and almost 78% of Minnesota is in some level of drought conditions right now. So, like, that is something that I'm thinking about. Not only just obviously, if you have like a standing water source, that can be a great place to use as an ambush site, especially if you're in an area that has kind of limited permanent water sources. But also, those water sources are those areas where you're going to have some of that last remaining lush vegetation around them, some of those forbs that are holding on. Deer get a lot of water, their water needs through the food they eat. So those areas around water can be fantastic, not only for them to stop and get a drink, but, you know, areas for them to get the last remaining green food sources that they're looking for, you know, as we get later into fall here.
I was down at my parents' place the last weekend in August, and I could not believe how dry the corn was already down there. I mean, it looked like end of September, early October. The kernels were indented. The stalks were already dried out. It looked completely ready to harvest by the end of August. I don't know. Do you anticipate, early crop harvest this year? That's something we normally, plays into our gun hunting strategy. I almost wonder if that's going to be more of a bow strategy as we get into the latter part of the month.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if crops start coming out early this year. I'll give you an anecdote. Out in North Dakota, there are already cornfields out. It was the driest it's been out there in decades where I was at. I saw a lot of deer hammering corn as a primary food source. Yeah, that's an interesting thing about early season is that beans get a lot of play, alfalfa, mm-hmm. things like that in areas mm-hmm. of agriculture. But corn can be awesome because what it provides is that food source, obviously, but it's an extra layer of security. If you can find an adjacent food source, kind of stack those food sources together. Last night I'm out scouting. I saw a huge buck cross the gravel road in front of me. He was bedded in this tiny, tiny little patch of brushy cover with corn surrounding him. And he was crossing that gravel road to go feed on what was beautiful, green, lush alfalfa, which is a rarity in our area. We don't see a lot of alfalfa around here. So he was onto it. He was bedding in a little area that most people would not even think of deer being bedded in at all. But because that corn is right there, you've got a food source, a security situation, and then that second food source right next to him.
This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline and Eric Morgan talking about next weekend, Saturday the 19th, archery deer opener here in Minnesota. Like we mentioned, seasons are already underway in the Dakotas, and Wisconsin's kicks off this weekend its archery deer opener. Let's talk about, kind of general tactics during what we associate with a normal year, and I'm not sure this is. It doesn't seem like we get very many normal years anymore, but you mentioned the story that's at outdoornews.com that you wrote that will also be in this week's print edition of Outdoor News. You had a subhead in there that said, "Don't sleep on mornings." You're right. We do talk a lot about evening hunts, and everyone's so worried about kicking up bedded deer by going in to a tree stand in the morning. Probably leaving some meat on the bone, so to speak, if you just totally ignore mornings, huh?
Yeah, and I think I get it a little bit for hunters because days are so long. So when you get in from an evening hunt, it's kind of hard to get up in the morning and go mm-hmm. again. Mm-hmm. Like we noticed that this past weekend, just it gets to be tiring. But I think if under the right conditions, whether it's in an oak ridge that's dropping acorns near bedding that you can get into with good access and get in there, they're going to slip from that bedding and throughout those morning hours, slip into those acorns, feed, slip back into bedding. What I see a lot, I hunt a lot of river systems. And if you are willing to use rivers and water access with a kayak, with hip boots, whatever it might be, to get in what I always say, the back door of a stand site. So you're going up the river while these deer are out on a primary food source, and you're slipping in under the cover of darkness in the back door into a bedding area. And the best locations are those areas that offer security, but they also on those river systems, a lot of times that's where those green food sources still remain, is up against those riverbanks and stuff. So what I've seen is if you're able to get in there good and you have a good wind, obviously that wind needs to be good in those bedding areas where it's blowing back across the river and not getting you busted. But if you can get in there, what they'll do is those deer, big bucks included, they'll hang out in that security cover and they'll just get up. They'll move 30, 40, 50 yards, really short distances and just browse, and then bed back down and everything. So it's certainly not an easy way to fill a tag necessarily always. It obviously, the rut is better when there's greater movement distances and stuff, but it can certainly be done.
So for next Saturday's opener, the 19th, where will you be sitting, Eric? And where do you think other listeners out there should be sitting when they go out and tackle the opener? And they shouldn't wait, right? A lot of people, we'll wait for the rut. Nah, man, that early season, that's some of the best opportunities we have to jump on a uneducated deer, right?
That's the big thing, is like these deer are uneducated at this point in the season. it almost is like you are hunting. You have like a window there where they just aren't, their guard is let down a little bit more. I will be actually one of the areas that I'm really interested in, if I can get a west-based wind, is I'm going to be going to an area that is surrounded by corn. It's just a little sliver of like a cattail willow slough. It's not big. It doesn't look like anything impressive on a map, but it's surrounded by corn this year. And I want to slip in up that corn edge in an evening if I can get the right wind. I've got a tree ready to go that's only about 6-7 feet high where my platform will be, because those little areas surrounded by corn interest me. And there's some oaks that aren't a long ways away. So I think if you can get those, if you can stack things together for people that are hunting around areas where, let's say you've got white oak acorns falling over a corner of a green bean field that's still holding on to green leaves, that's a fantastic area to think about for opener. You know, anytime you can stack those things together, or say it's far northern Minnesota where you don't have that agriculture component very often, maybe it's just where are those wet low ground areas that are going to offer, you know, in a drought year, not only that, like we talked about, that standing water source for them to get a drink, but also the most lush green food sources that are on the landscape. There's a lot that goes into it, but that's where I'll be on. I'm going to target on opener if I can get the right wind, is narrowing down the playing field and getting to some of those smaller areas that have those food components around them kind of intrigue me at this time of year.
Perfect. Well, good luck to you on opener next weekend. Good luck to you this weekend as you pursue those Dakota white-tailed deer. And I'd remind listeners, go to our YouTube channel, Outdoor News YouTube channel. You can see some of Eric's postings about deer hunting. He frequently posts some tips and ideas to improve your deer hunting. So check that out there, gear reviews, all that stuff. Thanks a lot, Eric. Have a good week ahead.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Appreciate it.
Eric Morkin, web editor at Outdoor News. Again, check him out at the Outdoor News YouTube channel. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
You know the drill. You got a free Saturday, the boat's ready, but you're scrolling through the same tired fishing reports trying to figure out where to go. Stop guessing and start catching. Onyx Fish lets you filter thousands of Midwest lakes by species, trophy potential, even keeper size, all backed by real DNR survey data. Plus, Onyx Fish is brand new on Android, so no more excuses. Try free for 7 days. Download Onyx Fish on the App Store or Google Play. Your next favorite lake is out there. Go find it.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a nationwide group working to keep public lands in public hands so future generations can enjoy what we enjoy. Join the group that makes a difference. Check us out at backcountryhunters.org.
Fall is coming, so waterfowlers, listen up. When birds are cupped over the spread, the last thing you need is a misfire. The Retay Ace's patented Inertia Plus system guarantees full bolt closure every single time. It handles light loads through 3.5-inch magnums with oversized controls for cold weather gloves, and its airy recoil pad reduces felt recoil up to 30%. Get elite performance and a lifetime warranty without the $2,000 price tag. Visit your dealer or RetayUSA.com today.
Sulfide ore copper mining threatens the health of the nation's most popular wilderness, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, right here in Minnesota. You can help keep the BWCA clean. Join Sportsmen for the Boundary Waters, pledge to protect the integrity of this incredible wilderness and its watersheds for hunting and fishing, for clean water, and for future generations. Join other hunters and anglers in demanding permanent protection of this national treasure. Visit sportsmenbwca.org to learn more about the threats to the Boundary Waters.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
Craig Engwall here from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association to talk a bit about chronic wasting disease. While CWD in deer is a serious matter, the situation is not hopeless. There are things that hunters can do right now to slow the spread of this fatal disease. For more information on what you can do regarding chronic wasting disease, you can go to the web and search Minnesota DNR, CWD, as well as the CWD Alliance. These web pages provide a great deal of information about CWD and the regulations pertaining to it. On behalf of MDHA, I want to thank you for doing all you can to protect Minnesota's wild deer herd from CWD.
As farmers and ranchers, stewardship of the land comes naturally. You help keep water clean, improve the soil, and provide habitat for wildlife. But did you know conservation can also improve your bottom line? Learn more at conservationpays.org.
Hey everybody, welcome back, Outdoor News Radio. I am Rob Gerisline. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you like the broadcast. If so, we got a print edition of Outdoor News you can subscribe to. Makes a great holiday gift. Call us at 800-535-5191 if you want it delivered to your mailbox every week. If you don't want that print edition, you can subscribe to digital editions. You can read a page-turner version, or you can read all of our content for all seven of our publications behind a paywall, but it's a nice cheap subscription at OutdoorNews.com. Tim Lesmeister here to help me wrap up this week's show. Tim, a bunch of other headlines we didn't get to. One, did you see the Minnesota DNR headquarters is going to move just a couple miles south to another location in St. Paul? Kind of an inside baseball sort of story, perhaps, for those of us who follow the DNR closely and have visited central office over the years. But it's going to be different. They've been at that current location since 1985.
I think it's always good to move every once in a while because you find things that you didn't know even existed. You know, as you're moving things, I think it's a good thing. I really believe that, you know, as times change and you start to move different people to different locations and sometimes integrate departments, it's good to get make a move like that so that you can just basically lay everything out exactly like it should be to be more efficient. And that's what you need in times like these, efficiency, because, you know, as they cut people and start to consolidate jobs and do things like that, you want to make sure that your operation is operating with all cylinders firing.
I suspect part of what's going on here is they just don't need as much space as they have had. Between the number of employees probably decreasing a bit and more employees, you know, hybrid model, working from home. I know the past couple of times I've been to central office, I'm amazed. I'll walk around the Fish and Wildlife Department and I'm amazed how many cubicles are empty. They just don't need the square footage that they've had. So I presume they're saving money by moving to this new location. It looks like a nice building, but again, to my point, they're not occupying all of it. And if they can be more efficient with space and I hope have a little cheaper lease, who's to argue, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it's true and all, but now they're going to have to find new hiding spaces for all those things that they don't want their bosses to find.
And that occurs next year, June of 2027. I have not spoke with the commissioner about it. Of course, she was heavily involved with the ELS, electronic licensing system transition earlier this year. And I got to think she'll maybe be happy that she probably won't be the commissioner next year, so she doesn't have to deal with a move, because that doesn't sound like fun.
Yeah, probably. I wouldn't mind seeing her come back as commissioner, if you want to know the truth. I think she's been done a really good job.
Outdoor News Radio, Rob Gerisline with Tim Lesmeister. We are winding down this week's program. In Beyond Minnesota, Tim, we had an Illinois angler, a young guy, win the Bassmaster Angler of the Year title. Now, this isn't the classic. This isn't winning the classic, but this is kind of the best overall score throughout the season, right? You know more about this than me.
Well, this is what every angler in the country that follows Bassmaster, you know, they know that someone winning the Classic is just basically the planets lining up for them. But when you win Angler of the Year, that means you've been consistently good all year long. And that is a feat. And they get a lot of respect for Angler of the Year. Plus a check for $100,000. But what's interesting about this is in the past, most of your AOIs have been, you know, the ancients, the ones that have been in the fishing tournament business for years. And these guys were in their 50s and 60s. And it took them a long time to get to the point where they were able to put together a string of tournament high finishes that gave them the Angler of the Year title. You don't have to win a tournament to make Angler of the Year. You just have to do well in a lot of them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now we're seeing this guy right here, 24 years old. No, 23, I guess he's 20, because Kevin Van Dam was 24 when he won Angler of the Year. He was the youngest, and now we have Trey McKinney now from Carbondale, Illinois. It's only his third year as a pro, and he's Angler of the Year. So that tells you that these kids, we call them kids, why not, are actually winning and winning big, because It's all about the electronics. Bass fishing used to, you know, these guys never even used their sonars in the past. You know, they fished shoreline cover and they fished shallow water. And to them, you know, sonar was nothing. But now it's everything.
Yeah, this has been a big story. I've been talking about forward-facing sonar for years, and it seems like everyone finally understands just what a big deal is. It's my understanding there was a story in the Wall Street Journal about this, Tim, that you know, talking about how some of the older anglers are a little ticked off about this. But yeah, these young guys are dominating in part because of forward-facing sonar. Now, tell me if I'm wrong, Tim. Do some of these Elite Series events require you not to use forward-facing sonar? I thought they kind of mixed it up so that, you know, for that very reason. But I mean, you can still pre-fish with forward-facing sonar and do a lot of research in the days leading up to an event and figure out where the fish are, right? So yeah, it's been an absolute game changer. And I mean, you know, it's not like Trey McKinney is an outlier. There's a bunch of young guys out there doing very well. And it's in part because they're just so comfortable with this technology.
The second place angler of the year, it was a young, very young Canadian.
Right.
And we had a Canadian win this Bassmaster Classic here just a few years ago. So you're talking about situations where everything is topsy-turvy now. It used to be all these just, you know, these guys from down south, Texas, Florida, yeah. Alabama. Those were the guys that won the tournaments. And Denny Brower comes out of Missouri, and he's hot. Well, you know, now it's guys from Carbondale, Illinois.
Right.
You know, yeah. It's guys from Canada.
Yeah.
It's guys from Minnesota. Our Minnesota guys are doing extremely well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those Minnesota guys never held a candle to those Southern guys for years.
Right.
It's all changed now. And now we're seeing guys that are in their early 20s dominating the tournament circuits because everything has changed. And now they realize those big fish are deep. I can find them with my forward facing sonar. I can come up with something that's going to trigger bites, and I'm going to win this tournament. This guy, in his last tournament, popped a 6-pounder and said, you know, right when I caught that fish, I thought I got a chance. And he did. He won.
Tim, before we go, another quick Beyond item involving the Grand Canyon. I ran that. I actually ran a photo that I took in the Grand Canyon of this little tiny stream, this little trickle of a stream that I saw when I backpacked through there, I don't know, 6 years ago. Well, that stream was a raging torrent here a couple of weeks ago when they got, you know, some rain presumably by the North Rim that came roaring down Bright Angel Creek, blew out that very campground where I stayed, the Phantom Ranch, that whole area, and at least 2 people killed. Yeah, it's my understanding that the storm that hit wasn't a huge amount. It was like an inch of rain, but it drains a huge area. And I guess there had been rain in the area earlier, so the soil was already fairly saturated. And throw that one more inch of rain and boom. Big story for one of our national parks.
Yeah, this was flash floods exponentially.
Yeah.
That can happen. I was camping down in Northeast Iowa one time down at Little Paint Creek, and we had an incredible amount of rain going all day long, but the creek, you could see it rising, but it didn't look like it was too bad. But that they came around and said, you guys really should think about packing up and getting out of here because we've got a big storm coming in. And we did. And we went up to our place on high ground, and then that night it poured. And all that water that had saturated the ground during the day couldn't take up any of that water that came in that night.
Right.
And the flash flood just came through there, and it literally lifted up bridges, moved them. It literally changed the direction of the creek in some places. And if we'd have been there, it would have literally wiped us out. So, you know, you got to listen to those warnings and you got to pay attention because, man, something like that happens and it'll kill you.
Especially in this part of the country now, we get a lot of these 1 and 2 inch and 3 inch rainfalls in southeast Minnesota, northeast Iowa, your neck of the woods. Yeah, it can generate a lot of water in those valleys quickly. Tim, we're out of time for this week, but thanks a lot for joining me. I'm looking forward to chatting with you again next week. And
yeah, we'll catch up to you soon.
All right, have a good week ahead. See you, Tim. That was Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him, all of our other guests. Everybody, have yourself a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Gerisline signing off for Outdoor News Radio.
Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.